Hey everybody, John Henry Soto here along with George Batista. As always, welcome to Counterparts. This is where we spotlight conversations on creative minds, talented minds, inspiring minds. And we're very excited today. We have Wesley McInnes is going to be on the show today. He's a filmmaker. He's in movies. He's on Netflix. He's a musician. We're going to have such a great conversation today. I am super excited to have him on the show. So please, please hang on tight and come on back. All right, welcome back, everyone. Thank you very much. In case you hear chopping in the background, I do my show at the kitchen of a Cracker Barrel. So that, but anyway, thank you everybody for tuning in. George, thank you. What's up? What's up?
Hello, sir.
Hello. So before we get started, we're gonna bring Wesley on. I just want to let everyone know that our season finale is on November 22nd. And we're doing something a little crazy on this day. We're inviting every single person. Wesley will be one of them if he's available to just come on and join us on the show here just for a conversation about what they're currently doing. We'll see who shows up. There's a lot of people. So this could be actually really fun, or this could be a complete disaster. Either way, we're going to make it fun. So we're excited exactly. about that. But that's November 22nd, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So please join us. We're going to have a great time. And George, take it away.
Thank you, sir. All right. So, as everyone knows, the Counterpart Show is brought to you by Wellness Resources, bringing you superior clinically formulated nutritional supplements since 1985. Find out why Wellness Resources nutritional supplements are the top choice of health-conscious individuals around the world. Make sure you go to myvitaminresource.com. And if you enter the promo code Counterparts, you will get free shipping on every, and that's right, every order. So make sure you check it out. All right. So as John said, today we're going to be talking to Mr. Wesley McInnes. So a little bit about Wesley. He is a multi-talented actor, musician, writer, director. He pours his passion for performing in every role. As an actor, he has a long list of television credits that includes DC Legends of Tomorrow, iZombie, The 100, Supernatural, Continuum, Smallville, Heartland, and The Vampire Diaries. He's also taken on roles in feature films, including the Power Rangers movie, Cold Pursuit, Beyond Magic Beyond Words, the J.K. Rowling story. In addition to acting, Wesley is an international singer and songwriter under the stage name Wes Mack. His releases have yielded 5 Billboard Top Hits, 20 CCMA and BCCMA nominations, over 15 million streams, and an international tour with Shania Twain. His latest role, he can be seen in the Netflix sci-fi horror series, The Imperfects. And we are very excited because we're going to talk about lots of things, film, music, and life. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Mr. Wesley McInnes.
All right. All right.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a great honor. Thank you so much for being on. We operate kind of, George likes to do things official. He has questions, official questions.
It's called being organized.
gotta have that, right?
Yeah, you gotta have some part of that, at least 50% of that.
Yeah, that's the balance, and, right?
It's, yeah,
exactly.
And the other 50% is I hear things and I'm like, ooh, I want to kind of ask about this. And I do have my notes. I'm not completely disorganized, but I do want to actually kind of flow a little bit with it. So I'm going to turn it over to George so we can start with our first question. Thank you so much for being here. And let's have some fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So just diving in a little bit about you. I know you started out in music when you were young.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. I mean, as three musicians here, you know, we love talking about music and the intricacies and all that type of stuff. Who were your influences when you were growing up?
Oh, man. I mean, so when I was a really little kid, I remember the first three, like, cassette tapes I think my parents ever, like, the ones that really stuck out for me, like when I started listening to music that wasn't just like children's music. It was, I had a Beatles tape, I had a Beach Boys tape, and I had a Hank Williams
scene. Oh, tape. Man.
Nice.
And so
that's,
I
guess, all you need right there.
Yeah, man. Honestly, I often have been like, oh, I was very well set up from the beginning.
Totally.
Because those are still, I love those three artists. Like, to this day, I'll still throw all that stuff on. So,
absolutely.
And then when maybe I was around like 10 or 11, I all of a sudden started like finding music on my own that wasn't just like what my parents had shown me. And I remember I got into listening to, for a while, it was like, you know, rock of that era of like I remember the Red Hot Chili Peppers were big for me, and like Our Lady Peace was big for me. And then by the time I was in high school, I had gotten really deep into listening to just everything classic rock. Like, you know, what, just my life was absorbed into like The Doors and Led Zeppelin.
Nice.
And which still is like, I remember the first time I ever drove a car on my own, I put in Zeppelin, I think it would have been Zeppelin 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, Whole Lot of Love came on. Oh, yeah. Freedom.
There's nothing like it, man.
Yeah, like if I listen to that song in a car, I'm speeding for sure.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, like, so I grew up in Calgary, which it's not Tennessee, but like there's a lot of country music there. And so that was something that was around a lot for me growing up.
Hmm.
But that, like, I didn't get into as a teenager, like when I was playing in a band and stuff. I think largely because you're kind of inundated with it there. It's like the Calgary Stampede is every year. Everything was country music. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And then weirdly, it was when I moved away from Calgary. I moved to Vancouver, where there's like a lot less, almost none of that. And that's where I got into country music. There was a guy on my floor in university who was from Boston, who was like a big Willie Nelson fan. And he just like was always spinning like bunch of country songs, and I found my way into it. And I remember specifically I saw Dierks Bentley play in 2008 on the Coke stage in Calgary, just like a mid-sizey kind of smaller stage, and it just like changed my opinion. It was sort of like a lot of the stuff that I loved from classic rock music all of a sudden being done in country, and especially when you look at like where rock was at in like maybe 2008, it almost felt closer to like older rock kind of thing did to me. It's just like, it had all the storytelling and all the melodies and stuff that I quite dug. So I've listened, there's many genres that I end up loving. And I realize I've wandered all over your question.
I mean, you actually answered it.
That's kind of the way we are, actually.
Yeah. I mean, that's
that's kind of the music way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you get turned on to the right things early on, you know, and that's really the important thing. Cause a lot of kids, you know, whatever is on TV is what they start listening to. And then that motivates their interest in music.
Totally.
And not all of it can be, but if somebody gives you those Beatles, I feel grateful for it.
Cause it
completely,
like,
completely.
It, I mean, man, it's just like so much came from those records. Like, they're just so pivotal. And like, there's nothing in music that is made today that doesn't owe some piece of DNA to artists like that, for sure.
100%. Yeah, George and I, we talk a lot about that here on the show, where we talk about how old music, we did a whole episode actually, how old music is kind of killing new music, because the 70% of the music that's streamed on these platforms is old music. 70.
Really?
It was an article from the Atlantic, actually.
Yeah, it's an article from the Atlantic.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, the guy is a Ted Goya, right?
Ted Goya.
And we follow him a lot. He's a writer, but you know, these are the stats, and so it kind of shows you how powerful that music was, you know, and how it's influencing. So it's like really important to see young people like yourself being able to take that music and kind of building on it and keeping that thing going, you know.
Yeah.
Do you remember when did you pick up the guitar? When was that?
Yeah. So I remember specifically I was 11, and I started learning how to, like, I remember I like my dad originally taught me how to play guitar. He played in a band. Well, he's played in a band a lot throughout his life, but like played in a pretty prominent one back in the 1960s that had a number one hit in Canada.
Nice.
So this is like always, it's funny enough. So my first guitar was actually his first guitar. It was a guitar that he bought when he was a kid. Sold it years later, then found it in a pawn shop years after that, rebought it. Said he bought it for $15 the first time and $25 the second time. And then that was the guitar I learned how to play on. So I remember, you know, he taught me some like initial chords, and I remember sitting there when I was 11 and I wrote my like first song. It was just three chords kind of thing.
Nice.
And then when I was 13, I started playing in a band with a couple of guys. It was a trio that we with my one one of my best friends still to this day. And we played in that together for till we were in our 20s. Like that was sort of most of my like lessons in music were all like in that playing in like, you know, going from community centers to like really shitty dive bars. And just like, I feel like it gave me a great appreciation for the times in my life when I've gotten to play bigger shows to be like, oh yeah, like I've truly played to zero people. Like I remember specifically on one occasion we were touring in a rock band and we were playing in a bar and the bar staff went on a smoke break and there was no one in the bar. So we were actually just having a band practice at that point.
George and I have a story.
We have a story about that.
Yeah, we did that.
You kind of wonder, like, do we continue? And we're like, well, we are getting paid. And, I guess we just have a band practice here for free.
That's what we did. We just played. You know, the show must go on, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I have a question on something because one of the things that early on you said you started playing and then you wrote your song. You wrote a song, which is very interesting because sometimes a lot of, you know, younger when they're starting to play, they kind of want to learn a song first and they go and learn all the songs, but they don't write anything until much later, which happens a lot as you get, you know, then you have to learn. But you seem that you went right in there early on. You wanted to write right from the beginning.
I did. Yeah. I've never really thought about that. But yeah, I guess I would have been, that would have been one of the first things I did when I had a guitar kind of thing.
See, that's awesome.
I didn't really, there wasn't really a thought process to why, but I remember specifically, it's still quite vivid in my head from many years ago, of just being like, well, this is what I want to do now. Like these guys all wrote songs. I got to write a song.
Right. That's one of the things that we started out with also was like, I just wanted to write. Like I knew all these great songs, but I thought to myself, I'm not going to play Led Zeppelin and I might learn how to play it exactly, but I can listen to it also. You know, I want to actually create something. Totally. And that was kind of my thought process on that. But yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
George, it was interesting because I, you know, talking about discovering Zeppelin and stuff like that. I mean, John and I always talk about the story that he found these CDs. It was Zeppelin CDs and Rush CDs. And it was actually, you know, moving pictures with Tom Sawyer, Rush and all that. And I didn't know about Rush until he said, George, you got to listen to this. Yeah. We were teenagers. And when I put it on, changed my life. That was
I created a monster, actually.
There's something about those moments, though, when I've found there's many of those I can point to where it's like you had no concept of that band until that moment. And then all of a sudden it infiltrates your life in a way that's like just it takes over everything kind of thing. Yeah. Like I remember feeling that way with The Doors when I first listened to their stuff. Yeah.
And I get embarrassed about it, but I remember being so naive and listening to Zeppelin and then getting so obsessed that I want to find everything.
Yeah.
And then
you go out
and you're like, do you know that these guys were around in the 70s?
Dude.
Do you know how many albums they have that we haven't listened to yet?
This keeps happening to me still as an adult, though. Like, I will admit, for whatever reason, in my like classic rock era, I never got into Fleetwood Mac. It just never happened. It never landed on my radar. Wow. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was honestly because their song showed up in that Guardians of the Galaxy. I think they used the chain in it.
Right.
And I was like, oh man, who is this? And I looked it up. I'm like, I was aware of Fleetwood Mac, but in my brain, Fleetwood Mac had a female singer and they just had that song Dreams and that, like it was off Rumors. And it was like, that was what it was. And I all of a sudden just like fell down the rabbit hole. Like, I think the tricky thing with them is because they have three singers, they have three very distinct sounds.
Yes,
right. Exactly. Even across, like even on that, on Rumors, you have three, like those could be, you could divide up the catalog into those three singers and it would all be great for each of them. So, you know, like minor point to me of like, oh, that's like slightly misleading but like you might not know it, but I just fell down this rabbit hole being like, oh my God, there are so many songs by these guys that I already love that I just didn't attribute to Fleetwood. And so I love them so much.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I got with into Fleetwood and then realized Lindsey Buckingham is like freaking amazing guitar player and has an array of like solo albums.
Oh yeah.
I went into that whole trap, you know, years ago and but I love it because, you know, you're always exploring. And I think as an artist, if you don't go out there and try to find something that you don't know about,
Yeah.
Now, why are you going to say, you know, I mean, I'll do that. I'll listen to the same song over and over again for
I do that too, right?
You know, just like go back. We all do. You know what I mean? But
it stimulates some pathway in your brain. It makes you feel good.
It feels good. So I just keep doing it. But then there's that time when you find that one piece of music that you're like, wow, I can't believe
it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's overwhelming when you find that artist and you realize they have 20 albums or something like that. And you're like, how do I even begin to, like, with Fleetwood, I was like, oh, man, if I try and digest this all at once, it won't work. So I was like, just gonna listen to Rumors for a while. We're gonna get into Tusk after that. We're gonna migrate around and do this piece by piece. Too much.
Yeah. I get nuts. I go to the first one, and I'll just play that, and then I'll go to the second one, third one.
Oh yeah.
Wherever I just keep going, and if something hits, you know, then you start remembering. See, back in the old days, because I'm old, but I used to have to like go to the record and write it down. You know, track number 7.
Yeah.
From this record, and then that's the one I want to listen to.
You know, in credit to that, though, I sometimes find it's easier to like remember things in an era. Like, this is kind of my whole deal with not just with music, but with just information in general. It's very easy to get any information you want right now very quickly.
Yeah.
But I find as a result of that, you don't retain much of it because you can. It's so easy to come by that it's easy to let it go. Like I kind of make the comparison of like if you wanted to know an obscure baseball statistic and it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago or something, like maybe you have to go to a library. Maybe you have to call someone. Maybe you have to write a letter. Maybe you have to there has to be like enough to make you really care about that piece of information. So when you get that piece of information, it might stick in your head.
Right.
The number of times I look up some like obscure, I'm on Wikipedia, you know, 13 articles deep and you have no idea where you even started. Right. And you don't remember what you're looking for. It's nice that you can have it, but I do find it's same with music of if you find a song and it's easy to quickly stream it, like it might not stick with you in the same way of like needing to like I don't remember adding an album to my phone in the same way of like when I would line up outside. We have HMV in Canada, was like our music store when I was a kid kind of thing. So you line up there and you get that like thing in your hand and it's tangible.
Yes.
I think we take a memory for granted.
Yeah, totally. Oh, I thought about the other day I was saying like, oh, I was saying this to my acting agent a ways back. I was like, oh, you know, in the future, I suspect we're all going to, you know, maybe you will have like a RAM or a memory upgrade that could be physically implanted into you, like that would expand your own memory. And she's like, oh, we kind of already have that. You access it through your hand.
That's
right.
Right.
But it's like, you do kind of have it. Like, you know, if I want to remember what I was doing on a given day, I frequently will just go to my photos and be like, oh yeah, I took a picture of that. Like that's where I was.
Exactly.
Yeah, and if not, Facebook is there to remind you every single day what you did last year.
Or 10 years ago.
So we'll be there.
It'll get weird when it's like, what were you on this day 70 years ago?
Yeah.
Facebook's
been
around.
Hey, what the hell was I doing? Oh, cow, I used to look like that.
Yeah.
What am I wearing?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to know.
So how did the whole Shania Twain thing come about?
To this day, I barely know. I'd signed a record deal, and I'd put out a couple of songs on my own that, as an independent artist initially, that I managed to have a top 10 hit in Canada, and I just had no team at the time, and that sort of started me having a music career. Well, I mean, I guess I had a music career for many years before that, but it was playing in like bars to no one, and which at times was the most fun part of the whole thing. But yeah, so we just put out my like first label single. We were 2 months into it. It was doing well on the radio, and I got a phone call from my manager saying like, "Hey, Shania Twain would like to have you out as the opening act on this tour." And like obviously I was, you know, doors blown off. I was like, I thought it was a joke. I you know said yes immediately. All those things. But to this day, I always kind of find this a bit of a novelty that like I don't really know who pulled the string. Like somebody surely pulled the string. It wasn't like it's like she could have anybody in the world. And usually in the music industry, people are pretty quick to like take the credit for like, it was me. I did it. I remember I ran it around the horn of the people I was working with, and everyone was kind of like, yeah, it's all about having a good team, you know, and nobody really ever like took
credit
for it. So to this day, I don't know what percentage of that was organic through her, prompted by someone. I like to think I was doing some of the right things at the time, and got the opportunity to do it. The main thing I liked is, well, many things, but we got brought back for the second leg of the tour, which to me was like the real proof where it's like, all right, we didn't screw up the first leg. Like they could have gotten rid of us after this point. So they asked us to come back for the second.
That's awesome. And you're great. Cause I mean, I was listening to your music earlier and you know, it's very, you know, I was thinking like, shouldn't he be in Nashville?
I've spent a fair bit of time down there. I haven't gone a bit. You know, obviously, you know, the last few years have kind of been wacky.
Right.
It changed a lot of travel plans. I've ended up doing a lot more like Zoom writes, which I used to find I didn't like, and B, a lot of people I knew, like writers in Nashville, really didn't like doing that. And then it sort of just became you had to do it. And so it's kind of continued a fair bit more. Now, but I would really like to make a trip back down there. I've been meaning to do it for a bit. A bunch of my, in the last handful of years, a ton of my friends have moved down there. Like the last time I went down, less of my like social circle lived down there. Whereas now I have a bunch of pals who've moved down there and have families down there and stuff. So it's a really, really fun town.
I mean, it is a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much to do. Obviously the music is really, I mean, when I say everywhere and George, I keep telling George lives in New York. That's where we're both originally from New York. And
I love it there as well. I've only been to New York once. I really want to go there more
often. Oh, wow. New York is great. Yeah. But yeah, the amount of music that's around, like, I mean, there's a stage at a Taco Bell.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
That blew me away when he told me that. I couldn't believe
it. There's a stage. There's always artists performing at the Taco Bell. So you can get
It blows my mind. I mean, I think the thing that made me realize is, you know, how much of Music Town it is. You land in the airport and some of the airport announcements are made. It'll be like, hi, this is Brad Paisley. Don't leave your bag unattended. <That's> right. All right. I get where we're
that's
at.
Right. You get it, yeah.
Again, for anyone later watching this, I am not exaggerating. Like Brad Paisley, no, he never been due to give you like baggage announcements.
100%.
Not live.
But, yeah. 100%. Yeah. No, he's sitting in a booth there. Can I go home now?
That would be the real thing.
Four more.
And it's true. You can't throw a rock in that town without being someone who is tremendously talented.
That's right. Yeah, that's the thing about it, too. You can go out anywhere on Broadway and really hear some. I mean, Broadway is a little bit of a different beast, you know, where there's a lot of covers going on there, you know. And there's, I don't know, 20-something clubs on that strip.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll hear Living on a Prayer in, you know, four
different times. We keep track of that when we'd bop around there. You go to Roberts, you go to Tootsie's. Yeah. It's like, yeah, was that the same band?
Living on a Prayer. I remember once standing in the middle of Broadway and I was talking to a friend of mine and there was Living on a Prayer there and Living on a Prayer here, but they were like four measures ahead. So it was like,
you got to get them synchronized. You don't
get a reverb. Like, guys, ready? One, two, and.
Amazing.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the music because I was listening, like I was saying, some of the songs. Now the track "Ain't Got You,"
yeah,
that's a new one.
Yeah, that is a new one.
That's a new one. Yeah, that's a really great track.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Honestly, I'm stoked to get to chat on this. That's the first time I've ever put out a single that I just wrote on my own that I didn't co-write with anyone.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it's funny because, like, you know, when I started writing when I was like younger, usually you wrote everything alone, and I continued that for many years. Even when I was playing in a band, usually it was one person kind of wrote the whole song and then brought it to the band. But when I started, you know, dipping my toe into country music and going to Nashville and stuff, obviously, like, co-writes are the name of the game there. And so you write with a ton of other people. And that was honestly, like, I really enjoyed that as well. A totally different experience. It's more of like a production, but you do learn a tremendous amount in doing that. Like, I feel like my ability to write over the few years of initially going down there and doing trips expanded a ton because you get to write with people where it's like I remember one of my songs that, you know, the guy had written, like Carrie Underwood's "Jesus Take the Wheel." And we were, you know, sitting there writing and say, you pick off like the little tricks that everybody, you know, some things about songwriting are very organic and, you know, it's, you wake up with the song and it's just in you, but some of it is knowing the mechanics of it as well. And knowing like, okay, cool. When we're coming out of the pre-chorus, how should the chorus pop up? Like it's just like little tricks. And I found, you know, doing a lot of co-writes over the years, you pick up other people's, you know, best tricks and you put them in your own bag of tricks kind of thing. And then you need to keep writing. So for Ain't Got You, it was kind of back to the organic thing though of 95% of all the songs I write, I probably write either in the shower or while having breakfast. Like, it just, that's just one of my, I find it's me doing another task actively frees up the subconscious to do something good. And I was making breakfast and I got the idea in my head and I sat there eating some Fruit Loops and kind of put the rest of the song together. And it was really quick. I think it was probably, 15 minutes or something. And it was which I find, I'm grateful for those ones where they're the really easy one where it just kind of feels like it falls out of you. But yeah, it was a weird one to put out because I wrote it alone, probably only myself, one or two friends and the fellow producing it, would have heard it before it came out. So it was this very insular kind of thing.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. You know, it's funny when you talk about the quickness of it, you know, sometimes that's like, it just falls out, you know, it's this there. And I got saw an interview with Tom Petty, who talked about, you know, his famous song, She's a Good Girl.
Free Falling.
Yeah, you know, he was like, I didn't even think it was going to make the record. I wrote it like in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Right.
And it turned out to be the biggest thing, you know, which is like, just crazy.
And it's like, you can't know. I find usually when you write a song, you're too close to it to know.
Right.
I, at the end of writing any song, I'm certain it's the best song I've ever written. And then usually that fades over like some amount of time. Like I find usually to be able to finish a song, you got to be feeling pretty good about it or it will fizzle before you finish it. And then, yeah, it's the tricky thing is knowing, like, it's trying to like find a way to create stuff and not have it be entirely dependent on how other people end up perceiving it. Like, it's hard to not fall into it a little, like nobody's immune to it. Like what I mean is like, when I'll put out a song, you know, when I put out my first single that like kind of gave me a career and went top 10 or whatever, I feel more positively about that song surely after all that happened than I did at the beginning. Like, it wasn't like I knew on day one, like I felt good about it. But after the fact, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a hit for sure. But it gets colored by the fact that it's like, cool, like this gave me some financial freedom in my life and this gave me some career opportunities and this like allowed me to do the fun things that I wanted to do. So obviously I have this warm spot in my heart for the negative converse effect is when you put out a single that you think is great, it does terribly or does nothing. And then you go like, it was never really that great, was it? It's kind of like, I almost want to like record a journal on the day I put every song out of like what I actually think of the song. Then you can review it years later and be like, did you know?
It's interesting. I'm hearing a lot from songwriters and stuff that happens a lot because it's funny. I'm a fan of the group Toto.
Love Toto.
Yeah. And I saw an interview the other day that I hadn't seen and they were talking about Africa. And they were saying that Africa was like completely the only song on the album that didn't match the rest of the album. They were like, they didn't even want to put it on the album. And they were like, this is not going to go over. This is not going to be, they were completely against the song and they just put it in there. And look what happened, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason I'm aware of Toto at the end of the day. Like, you know, there's many other amazing songs in their catalog, but like, that song comes on and it's tremendous.
It's wild.
But there's a lot of instances like that. You have like, you know, band MGMT.
I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they would have had like a three really absolutely massive hits in the late 2000s.
Right.
That when you go back, like I'm a big fan of them. And it's like very like electro pop kind of hits,
right.
But just those three songs are, when you listen to the rest of the album and every album they've ever done since, it's more like surfer rock kind of thing, or like even and they even more experimental. Those three songs though were like in their own words were like massively different, but they're the thing that gives them a career. And I remember when like people when their second album came out, I think there was a lot of pushback being like, where are the like electro pop hits? And it's like you kind of have to accept when you look at the body of work, you're like, oh, but that wasn't really ever the band they were. Like they had these three things that were kind of anomalous to the rest of their writing process. Yeah. I think that happens, you know, oddly, it's not infrequent for that to happen.
Right.
Yeah, and I think also when you have an artist that's been writing a certain genre by themselves for a while, and then they get with a group and in a studio, that changes
the
dynamic of what they're putting out. It may be still their song, but it's a little bit different. So when it gets out there, you know, then they're listening, you know, whatever that happened. If it's a big hit, then when they go back into the studio, they may go in with a different producer. They may have a different set. Now that changes it. So that second, that second album is, you know, well, it's always that second album.
You debate, you know, did you catch lightning in a bottle the first time? Are you going to try and chase that down and go after it again? Try and avoid it altogether. These are challenging decisions that you know.
It's hard. And then you'll hear people say, well, you got to just do what you got to do. Don't pay attention to anything and don't pay attention to no one and just be you. Just be you. And it's like, that's so easy to say. But when you're sitting there with a paper, you know, a pencil and a piece of paper and a guitar, you're still you and you all these thoughts come into your head.
Well, and the stuff I find that never gets talked about, like beyond the creative process, is like, I like having hit songs. Because they allow me to do fun things in life. Like if I have a song that does well, what that translates to for like, I have sort of a theory on like how I see like money and fame as quantities, not ends in and of themselves, but like things that you can exchange for other experiences or for safety or for, you know, for whatever it might be. So for me, like having hits equates to like having fame and notoriety that for me isn't the end. It's the like, oh, cool. I get to go and play on a stage where the sound is really good and where people want to sing the song, or I get to like go and shoot a music video with an interesting premise where we make it build a spaceship and do, you know, creative-y things. Yeah. So like to try and say like, oh yeah, just do you, like just write whatever.
Right.
It's part of the equation though, is like, I want those things because they allow me opportunities in life.
Yeah, freedom, you can help others also. Yeah, you could
entirely. It's impossible to turn around and like help the person behind you if you're like still just like crumpled in the ditch kind of thing. You know, it's like, it's easier to help people around you if you have means.
And it's great to hear you say that as a young artist, because George and I talk a lot about this, about these starving artists thing. Right. People, you know, it's like, guys, let's stop talking about this, because the more we actually start giving life to the idea that starving artists is a thing, the more we're going to have them.
Yeah,
there's no reason why you should create your art and not get properly compensated for
entirely.
You know,
totally. I remember at the start of the pandemic, it was a great time to zoom in on it, when you can often hear arguments about, oh, like, you know, what's essential, what isn't essential, and sort of like, the people really need art. But I think it's underestimated how much of your life is involved, like of even beyond the, so the obvious ones are like, cool, like you take the average person and if you tell them you can't listen to music or read a book or consume any kind of television or film at all, and also you don't have any like pattern on your shirt,
right?
And also like basically strip all the like texture out of out of life.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would
a beige world.
Yeah.
I know. I talk about that also, about like this pencil. Somebody had to like say, okay, it's going to be green here.
Oh, they had to design it.
Somebody had to design it. As simple as this is, there was somebody that said this pencil brand is going to be like this. This mouse, this computer, this mug was me. I did the logo.
Oh, dude, no.
But the, you know, everything that's around us is designed. You know, this design. Right. This is a comedian from Nashville. You know, and so it's art. It's artists. So artists really rule the world. They run. They influence.
You have a hard time imagining it. If you take all of that out, you might survive, but you surely wouldn't thrive. Like I just feel like nobody would be very happy about it.
Yeah, I don't even know if you can really survive walking. In a beige neighborhood. You know, we'll all be sitting here right now and just in beige.
And what would you talk about?
What would we talk about? We'd be like, hey, the other day I saw a light color beige.
Yeah,
it was pretty cool.
I mean, I guess you can enjoy. You'd have like a nature aspect, but that would be the limit of.
But even nature, I mean, who's our biggest artist, right? Yeah. Would be, you know, not to get too philosophical, but creator of all.
It's right there, right?
There's beautiful stuff around. So it's like, you know, but yeah, George and I get philosophical here. So we apologize.
Yes, we can get deep on this show.
We get
gotta go deep, man.
So, George, you have a question here.
Actually, I wanted to ask him now, kind of going from the music piece, how did the acting thing start for you?
Yes, that's where I was going to go.
Yeah, when I was in second year university, I was sitting in a quantum mechanics class. I was getting an arts degree, but I was planning to get a minor in physics because I was good at that in high school. Like I was like physics, calculus. That was like a strong suit of mine. And as I was sitting there, though, in my second year, I was like, okay, at this point, I'm going to get a physics minor clipped onto an arts degree, which doesn't really turn into any, like, you can't really, if you wanted the physics degree, you got to go full on and get that. But I'm going to expend probably all my time leaning into it because the classes were just harder and more time consuming. And I, at the time, was playing in a band and enjoying, you know, life and getting an arts degree. And I was like, okay, these don't quite match up anymore. So with a day left before you need to drop your courses, I walked out of that quantum mechanics class, went down to arts advising, dropped all my math and physics classes, and I grabbed a smattering of other like arts courses, and one of them happened to be an acting class that it wasn't like a random grab. I was interested, but it like wasn't something that I'd put a lot of thought into before, and I just loved it. I went on to, following that, I took every acting class that you could take at UBC without actually going into their like full-on Bachelor of Fine Arts, and so I did that. I, you know, did some plays, did a musical, and then I got an agent, and on my last day at UBC, I walked out of my last class. It was very strange timing, and I got on the bus, and I had booked a one-line part on The Vampire Diaries, and that was sort of this like,
nice
career handoff moment there, where so I graduated from UBC, and then I started, you know, going out for acting roles.
That's the way it's supposed to go, right?
Yeah. Oh, it was very serendipitous.
Yeah. I love that. When you started going in for auditions, were you going in already with an agent?
Yeah. I mean, so I would have done a string of auditions while I was at UBC, both for theater and for like student productions without an agent. But as far as I know, it's not like in the music world, you could go book your gigs on your own,
right?
But within acting, I don't know of anyone booking like, or even doing auditions at like a pro level without an agent. It's a little more codified. So from very early on, I had an acting agent there who is still my acting agent to this day. That's big awesome. Fan of her.
That's great.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I got into that.
That's great. One of the things I always talk about with actors is just the audition process, because that seems to come up a lot in conversations with other actors on film sets and stuff. Has been the process of their audition. Like some people will say, you know, auditioning really means absolutely nothing. You know,
it's its own profession. Everything.
It really is. You know, there was a documentary called that I've mentioned on here before called it's a lot of character actors together, and they were being interviewed, and it's actually called, the documentary is called That Guy Who Was in That Thing.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of this. I haven't seen it, but I've heard of this.
Very good documentary. And but one of the actors there, he was saying, talking about auditioning, and he kind of said, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you walk into the audition room and you remind the casting director of your of his brother-in-law that he really loves.
Yeah.
Great. Or you walk in there and remind him of his brother-in-law that he really hates.
Yeah. And you don't have control of that.
Right. So it's sort of like you don't have any control of that. And the other day I was listening to Lisa London, who's a casting director in Los Angeles. She was interviewing someone. And he said, you know, when you go in, the first thing you should, I want to get your take on auditioning on this. When you go in, to a reason, you can ask questions, but you shouldn't be like, so what is this character's purpose? Like, what am I trying to, you know, you can.
I definitely have opinions on this for sure.
Yeah. and then when you're done with your audition, and I've seen this because I started out in front of the camera also, and I remember sitting in the room, and you're sitting there and you hear the other audition, and then at the end of the audition they're like, oh great, I saw that movie, you know, I saw the thing, it was really great, the guy, you know, when do you know when you're going to start making decisions, when you're going to start shooting?
Sure.
And you know they're trying to work.
For sure.
You know, they have a lot going on. So what are your thoughts on that process, because it's always fascinating to me.
Totally. So okay, so in terms of questions before, I'm very adamant of I don't want to ask anything before. And usually when I would enter like an audition, I mean, honestly, I haven't done an in-person audition since COVID happened. It's all been self-tapes, which is its own animal. But in the room, you would often get asked beforehand, like, do you have any questions? Like, do you want any like more information on this? And my intent was, I would always say no, in that like, I'm going to give you my take on it first. I'm going to give you what I've prepared. And then if we want to go again, if there's like changes you want made, then we can talk about it. Then we can pick it apart. And the reason I specifically always try to do that was that, like, I kind of don't love when you ask a question, you could get a very big curveball that very much changes. Like, because this happens all the time where there's like something that's not in the page that they know. And if they tell you this right beforehand, that it's like, oh, actually, this is your death scene. Like, you die at the end of this. So, like, you know, like, okay, cool. Like, I thought I was juggling and like having a good time. Like, that's sometimes the case. You know, maybe things are very redacted in the script. So I like to, you know, I will make all of my decisions and preparation and choices in advance, and I will bring that in and put that out on the table for you. And then if they go, cool, we hated that, let's pick it apart, or that we loved it, like try it this way. So that's kind of my two cents on that.
And taking notes when they give it to you and actually doing them is really an important thing. If you tell an actor, I've done casting for some stuff, and you give him a note, like one actor I remember saying, okay, you're not really angry at him. You're not angry.
Yeah.
You know, okay, but you're kind of like energized, but you're not angry.
Yeah.
And he kept coming angry and he kept coming angry. Yeah. It was like four or five times, and he don't understand. So.
Oh, and it's tricky, right?
Real difficult thing to be in, you know, on both sides of it.
It's a weird pressure cooker. And I really, it's its own skill set. Like, you'll hear actors say, like, oh, I'm a professional auditioner. And like, I for fun get to go and act in movies sometimes, because like once you're like on set, there's a different level. You're very supported. You have a team of people who all want and need you to succeed, which I guess arguably you do. You know, sometimes the thing I try to remember with casting is that like they want you to be good as well. It bodes very well for them, as because it's like people forget that it's like they have a contract with the film to supply the right actors to it. So if they can supply a bunch of people doing a great job, everybody wins. But it's different. And it's like, it's when you're on a film set as well, it's like, you know, there's certainly obviously challenges, but one of the joys is when you're in your costume and the other person across from you has worked their character into the ground, and you have a gorgeous set sometimes around you, it can be very easy to slide into. There's not a lot of make-believe even left by the time that you're actually doing it. Like I've sometimes talked about, I get to shoot a movie with Liam Neeson. There's a sequence where he's literally just throwing me around up against this wall. And I, you know, and people ask me after, like, why would you like act like scared? Like, I don't have to act at all. Like, you have a dude who's like three, just winging you into a wall. Liam Neeson. Just like, hold on.
Me against the wall. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. Environment can actually give you that.
But in the audition for that, I don't have that. I have someone sitting 20 feet away from me being like, where's my son? Like, where, you know, who did this? You know, and not all readers are created equal in that. Sometimes you get people who give you a ton, and sometimes they may drop a line or something. So it's a frustrating but interesting process. For sure.
Yeah. And I think also the last 2 years with COVID, I think it changed so much with the
self-tape auditions,
self-tapes and stuff. But it's also given the casting people, I think they're understanding, because I spoke to a couple of them, they understand now, you know, they spent a lot of money renting these offices
that they don't need,
thousands of dollars. And now a lot of them are actually narrowing it down here and renting a space where they'll use for like a week.
I mean, I still haven't gone in. I did for the first time, I did a callback Zoom audition recently. And prior to that, everything that I've been cast in, like during COVID, it was just one tape, no callback. Just they watched it and they're like, all right, get them in. And it's been my favorite thing ever, because now I'm up at my cabin in the mountains, and I can do that because I don't have to be, you know, on standby for that. If I have an audition, I can tape it from here. It also changes your lifestyle a fair bit as an actor, where beyond where you can live, it's the difference between, oftentimes you would have, you know, 12 hours or something before an audition. You get a phone call at 7 at night. You got an audition at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Cool. So now you got to drop everything and rearrange your life and go and do that. Whereas if it's at 7 p.m., you get a call that says you have an audition due by 9 a.m. tomorrow. That's more, I can deal with that more easily. I can go, cool, I'm going to stay up a little late tonight. I'm going to tape this, go to bed, and still have the day that I plan to have tomorrow. So there's a bunch of stuff. I think it works out great for casting as well, because you could sit in your bed at home with a tablet and go, yeah. All right, I like that one.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. It's very, very interesting. So we're at 45 minutes. I want to actually make sure we talk about the Imperfects, actually, on Netflix. I started watching it, and I was scared. I'm not going to...
Spooky.
I'm not going to pretend like I wasn't, because... and then I saw, this comes up.
Yeah. You gotta be scared of that guy.
I was like,
you know, it's funny, the gas in the room was all added in post.
Really?
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it was one of the few times, like, I've worked with a lot of CG stuff, but this was an instance where, like, I expected something atmospheric, and I walk in the room and there's just nothing there. And it's one of the weird acty ones where you have to, like,
see like really
things seeping around you, and I'm like, all right, well, let's hope they're nice to me in post and at least put the gas where I can come in.
Right. That's so funny. So tell us a little bit about that. How's that going?
Yeah. I mean, it's going great. Like the release of it's been really fun to watch, like the reaction people have had to the show.
It's huge.
Yeah. It honestly, and it feels like this little, like, you can't know the scope of that when you're shooting it. Like I knew it was a Netflix show when I was working on it, but it was a Canadian production company and not like a gigantic, like, behemoth. We're not shooting like Stranger Things season 5. It's not the and so when you put that stuff out, it's same as putting out a song. You have no idea like what the reaction will be to it.
Right.
So it's been really, really wonderful seeing I saw some fan art that I was in fact, a couple of days ago. I'm like, oh, that stuff's so neat. And like, it doesn't ever get old for me to just I think about the shows that have meant the most to me in my life, and to ever be part of something like that for somebody else is pretty cool. And the experience was a ton of fun. Like I love the character I got to play on that show.
Yeah.
He's very similar to me in a lot of ways. just like total nerdy guy, all of a sudden given superpowers. I'm like, yeah, I know what that would be like. So it's been a tremendous experience.
A lot of times it's the writing really that really brings it over the top. And the writing is really good. You know, you'll have a lot of Netflix shows that are, then they get put out there. They'll do a season. The writing is such a major factor,
I think it's kind of the thing.
It's the thing. If you don't have the writing, because the actors, you have to find the right performer that's going to deliver those lines, and that's a major part of it as well. The director has to know the vision and understand how it's what they're doing, but the writing has to really it has to flow.
And it's really hard to say the writing is bad. It's one of those things like you can do everything else right, but the two things that can, if the writing and the editing are the two pieces.
Editing can kill it also,
you can have absolute gold. I've been in things that I felt like, this was great on the page. We shot something great. And
I was in one thing. I'm still upset about this. I was in one thing, and it was shot in Brooklyn. It was a feature, and I had this one scene. It was a long, pretty long scene. I really busted my ass on it. And I nailed it. It was so good that at the end when they yelled cut, I heard some people go, wow, that was freaking good. You
hear that's great. You won't usually get that.
Get that, right? Yeah. And I heard that.
Sure doesn't have time to be giving you an Oscar. Kind of
thing. Yeah. Didn't make the cut.
Oh, dude.
Didn't make the cut. Not only did it not make the cut, I haven't seen it.
I'm so sorry.
Dude, so I was like, what?
I know. I'm in the Warcraft movie, but I'm not in the Warcraft movie. I'm in the credits. My name is there, but my scene got cut out of it. There's a handful of things over the years where either I've been fully cut out or in something and a scene is missing or is heavily truncated or something like that.
Yeah.
It's always a drag when it happens.
It's a drag. Yeah. I mean, but you have to understand that, I'm not going to understand, but you do have to understand.
Dude, I'm right there with you. You have to understand, but I never will. And I'm always here, angry.
There's no understanding back here, but I get it up here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're at 50 minutes. We can probably go another hour. Yes. We want to thank you so much for being on. As usual, what I ask our guests is, the last 2 years have been very challenging for a lot of people sitting at home. Some of them are challenged with the idea of being able to confront the world again and being able to do things and just kind of just a lot of things going on. Do you have any words for anyone out there, maybe even some other actors that maybe haven't gotten out there yet because of concerns or whatever, you know, to for them to kind of get back on the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things with that, and I struggle with this all the time, is like you can set a goal and you want to get there, but it's very daunting because that the first steps are very tough. Because the first steps don't look anything like the final thing. I've had a lot of people ask me about, you know, songs over the years where they go like, well, my song doesn't sound like this, you know, finished Keith Urban song. And it's like comparing apples to oranges and comparing your earliest nuggets of something to other people's final work is a real disservice to yourself. So, I mean, I think especially coming out of the couple of years we've had is maybe just like, you don't need to have 10 out of 10 days every day. If you can like, just do something that feels good for you every day. You're getting there, and you're getting there at your own rate. You can't really know the journey that's going to take you, you know, to wherever you want to go. But the important thing is like finding stuff that like makes you feel okay in your own self and in your own brain, and not comparing yourself to your idols every single day. Cause that's it's a real disservice to yourself, you know, because you can't do it. There's no way to do it. So it's just sort of, you know, keep even, somebody said this to me recently, like you can have a 1 out of 10 day and like, as long as it's not a zero, as long as you can just keep, you don't have to, it still adds up to something. You're still moving the car forward. So like,
keep moving forward is always a key thing just even one thing. I always say, try to move the needle forward every single day on what your goals are, you know, and sometimes it can be just opening the book up of things you wrote down and just looking at what you can do that week. If that's all you did, at least you're going in that direction. You know, it's really difficult to just not move, you know, it just makes you not move even more in the future.
Totally. Yeah, being kind to yourself like that though, because even like a successful day could be making yourself a breakfast, you like, honestly, you know.
That's
like,
right.
it's the column you put it in at the end of the day, because like on a day where you feel great, that can be enough, and so it's trying to let those like small things be enough, because like the big victories in life are few and far between, and like oftentimes when you're looking at like, I look at some of my biggest, you know, successes, and there's often a ton of asterisks around them that nobody else in the world would see, but that I'm aware of, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So when you compare where your life is at to other people's that are way further along, it's missing all the asterisks, kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know we're wrapping up, but there was one thing that you said there. It's usually those moments that a lot of people don't see, you know, it's the quiet time. You know, George and I talk about this is when you sit there quietly with your own thoughts on what it is you're trying to accomplish and set your goals and start really focusing on what the next step is, that nobody sees that. You know, people see the work and they'll see things coming out and they'll be like, oh, that's awesome. How did you do that? You know, I was like, well, I sat quietly and you know, and it's like you said, being kind to yourself by doing that, because it's going to make you feel better when you do that.
Yeah. And it's finding the stuff that actually that you love as well. Like I always forget this. If I go and work on a song for a few hours, I can typically just feel better. It's something like I get caught up in a lot of the admin stuff and the tasks that aren't as fun as I'm sure everybody does in life. And you can at the end of a day of that feel like, oh my God, what am I doing? But it's to try and remember to like, even if you don't want to start it at, when you're starting one of those tasks, to like take the tasks that you know, like this always makes me feel good. And like, you know, give your foot almost, if you have to kick yourself in the butt to start doing it,
that's right.
Allow yourself to do those things you love.
100%. I love it.
Absolutely.
Wesley McGinnis, thank you so much for taking the time with us. We hope that you come back again.
I'd love to.
Absolutely. It'd be awesome to have you back. We're going to watch you on The Imperfects. The songs. Now I have this website. Is this accurate? Can people find you there?
Yeah, I think that redirects maybe to westmacmusic.com. It's a real website.
It's a real website.
Me on like Instagram, like at westmacmusic, and honestly all socials of at westmacmusic. I'm just more active there than on my website.
Well, we'll put that in the descriptions and we'll put that down there as well. But yes, make sure you check them out, and we really appreciate you taking the time to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Wow.
That is a cool dude.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Extremely talented, extremely cool. And he has a great outlook.
That's the only thing that really gets you there is when you have that viewpoint where you can actually look at your own self and what you're doing,
right?
And then matching those things up so you actually are part of and connected to it. It's absolutely not you here and that's over there. No, you actually are part of that thing.
Exactly.
And I love that part. So yeah, very, very cool. Thank you so much for being on, Wesley, and we will definitely see you again, and we're going to be following and all that good stuff. So I just want to remind everyone again real quickly that on November 22nd, we do have our season finale show, and we're going to have a lot of fun there. We're going to be I really don't know what's going to happen, to be honest with you. I think we're going to be there. I'll be there. The hat will be there. But maybe, I don't know exactly. I think it's going to be
some
interesting.
Maybe some A-listers will come on, you know. Ooh. Stallone or,
That'd be awesome. You guys are great. All right. That was terrible. All right, guys. Thank you so much, everybody, for watching. We'll see you again next week, Tuesday, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Counterparts, George Batista. I'm John Henry Soto. Thank you very much. And as always, peace.